This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome Jennifer Raymond. She's Associate Professor of Neurobiology at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So there are many kinds of bias, and the conscious, outspoken forms of bias are still with us, as we see among certain politicians and in racial bias here in the United States, but they're increasingly rare. Many people don't even know that they're biased. Both men and women, for example, can be biased against women. What are you seeing? What does bias actually look like in the world when we consider really important things like hiring and salaries and promotions and things like that?
Sure. Yeah, I think overt bias had been on the decline for a long time. Lately, it seems like we're seeing a lot more examples of that in the news, even, high-profile scientists saying that women are a distraction in the workplace, and the high-profile lawsuits in Silicon Valley about, overtly hostile climates for women in the workplace there. And so I think it's really important to address the overt bias, but I think unconscious bias is probably even a bigger problem, because at this point, the examples of people who, most people now really want to be fair. The examples of people who don't care about being fair are getting fewer and further between. But most people sincerely want to be fair. They want to choose the best person. They want to promote the best person. They want to recognize the best science or the best law, whoever's doing it. But we're prevented from doing that because most of us have an unconscious bias to attribute better qualities to the work produced by men and to the men themselves.
And it's not only gender, but also parenthood. Mothers are discriminated against and fathers are actually favored. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah, so if you just take a resume or you take a piece of work and you put a male versus a female name on it, people in general tend to rate it more highly if it has the male name. But then if you add to that a subtle cue that indicates that one of the resumes is a parent, by saying president of the PTA, for example, instead of president of the neighborhood association, the woman who is a mother gets rated as much less competent, offered less salary, and really takes a big hit in terms of assessment of competency. So unfortunately, moms are not viewed as competent in today's society.
And fathers are.
Fathers are. Yeah, so parenthood does not affect men's status, or if anything, gives men a boost.
So what about not only hiring, but promotion and salaries? I mean, we've come from, 69 cents to 73 cents? I mean, not a big change over a period of decades. Women are still pretty far behind. Is it really for the same jobs, or is, women's work paid less, or what are we looking at?
Yeah, I think salary really goes along with what we value, and I think we still value sort of the more male, kind of male-associated jobs, and also we perceive men as doing better work, and so we reward that proportionally. So, again, it comes down to this unconscious bias most of us have to view men as more competent, and this comes from just the mental habits we've developed throughout life to view scientists as something that is a male occupation or to view business as a male thing. And so when someone violates that expectation of what a good scientist is, then we tend to automatically assume that they're not as good. And then that plays out in hiring, it plays out in promotion, it plays out in salary. And it also plays out in how the individual behaves in the workplace. So gender bias is not something that men have against women. We all have the same biases. Women are more just as likely to be biased against women as men are. I've taken a test. You can take this online. It's called the Implicit Association Test. I'm a woman in science. I'm a mother. I train women scientists. And I firmly believe consciously that women, I've seen plenty of concrete examples, women can be just as good of a scientist as a man. But when I take this implicit association test, it shows that I have an unconscious tendency to associate science with men, despite all of the counterexamples that I've had. So these unconscious biases are mental habits that we've developed by the patterns of associations we've had throughout our life, the books we've seen, the media, all of the portraits of the male scientists hanging in the hallways. All of these things make us unconsciously tend to associate men with science or men with business or men with the workplace in a way that we don't do for women. And so if we want to overcome that unconscious bias, we have to be aware of it. There's some data showing that the more you think you're objective, the more likely you are to show these kinds of biases. So awareness is a first step in being able to use more conscious thought processes to say, okay, yeah, my gut reaction says choose the male candidate, but let me really look carefully at the data and see where that's coming from.
Does the opposite situation hold true? So, for example, for what is traditionally women's work like daycare or teaching or nursing, when men are in those professions, is there a bias that women would do it better?
There's some evidence for that, but it's not as strong. So, you know, men in a stereotypically female job, the data are really mixed. Sometimes they seem to be rated as less competent and sometimes not. But much more when women are in the male stereotypical job. I just saw a study about professors being evaluated by students, and male professors who are in a more traditional or female-associated field, like literature or music or art, are more likely in the student evaluations to be rated based on their physical characteristics, like hot or sexy, whereas women in the sciences are more likely to get those kinds of comments in their student evaluations. So that shows there is kind of a tendency to view people differently depending on whether they're in a field that's aligned with gender expectations or whether they're violating those expectations.
Now, how does academia compare to the rest of the working world? In other words, when you compare bias in the wide world of business and hotels and all the other fields that there are in this world versus in universities and colleges, is there any less bias in these fields where the people who are in them are supposed to be smart and aware people? I mean, that's part of their profession.
It would be nice if that was the case. I don't think so. I think academia is very much like any other competitive workplace. There was a study done on scientists where they did the same kind of study that I mentioned earlier, where you send a resume with a man's name or a female name, and it's the same resume, and you ask people to rate it. And this group sent it to science professors. And the same kind of study had been done many times. And when I talked to the people who ran the study, they said, well, that's because scientists said, oh, well, yeah, that study's been done, but we wouldn't do that because we're scientists, we're trained to be objective. So they repeated the study on the science professors who are trained, they are trained to be objective, we are, and yet they exhibited the same kind of bias, gender bias, that had been shown in other kinds of populations of people. They were more likely to rate the applicant as more competent if it was a male name, offered more salary, offered more mentoring too, which is especially scary when you think about our product in academia is our students. And so to the extent that we're not able to overcome these gender biases, then we are not delivering the same kind of training and education to our female students as we are to our male students. So I think we have the same unconscious biases, but if anything, we should be held to a higher standard to make an effort to overcome them, to make sure that our male and female students are getting the same chance, the same education, the same training, the same encouragement. And unfortunately, now the data suggests that we're not doing that. There's a failure at every level of the education system to encourage women, young girls, all the way up through college women, to encourage them at the same level that we're encouraging our male students.
You know, I was listening to a radio podcast last night in which some scientists had determined that if you take a group of lab rats and you tell experimenters that these lab rats are super smart and that another set of lab rats are super dumb, even though they're the exact same lab rats, the smart ones will do a lot better running a maze than the supposedly smart ones will do better than the supposedly dumb ones. And it turns out that the experimenters' expectations influenced the way they treated and held the little lab rats. Now, if that's true for rats, it can only be way more true for people. I mean, how a professor or a mentor treats a male or female or black or white or Puerto Rican, whatever, student, if their expectations are higher or lower, that will most likely influence how that student does.
True. So, you know, there's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the teacher and the student has a different expectation of what their performance is going to be, then that really influences the outcome. That rat study has also been done on children in a school setting where teachers were told that the researchers had developed some algorithm for predicting which student would have a breakout year and really do better than they had in the past. And that was just a ruse, and they randomly assigned the children and told the teacher, we expect these three kids are the ones in your class who will have a breakout year. And sure enough, those students actually did, by objective measures, have a breakout year because the teacher expected them to. So if we have different expectations of the performance of male versus female students in math, then that will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so it's our responsibility as educators to be aware that we have this potential bias to view male and female students as having different potential and to take conscious steps to put that bias aside and try to objectively treat them the same. So in the study I mentioned where science professors were more likely to offer more mentoring to the male applicant. So if we know that, then we can simply make a conscious effort to offer mentoring to female students, not because they need special help, but because we need to take the extra effort to give the girls the same training, right? We have to take the extra effort to offer the same opportunities to our female students as we do to our male students.
We're talking to neurobiologist Jennifer Raymond. Now, are there any oases of fairness? I mean, what about in art history or literature departments? Is there less bias there than in the sciences?
I think the numbers are different across fields, right? So there is a higher representation of women in the social sciences and in the arts. Even within the sciences, there are more male-dominated fields than others. But take a field like medicine. There are a lot of women MDs right now, but if you go to the highest ranks within, say, an academic medical center, then you tend to see higher representation of men at the top. You tend to see a higher representation of men in positions of department chair or dean in the liberal arts. So even in fields where women are making progress in the pipeline, they're not achieving the same levels of leadership that the men are.
The example in classical music was so clear and beautiful. At a certain point, symphony orchestras were like 95% men, and then they auditioned people behind a screen so that the people auditioning them didn't know whether they were male or female. And the composition of symphony orchestras shot up from predominantly male to anywhere from 25 to 50% women today. And those people who were making those decisions didn't even think they were biased. Are there, and music, you can do that. You can put somebody behind a screen. Is there any way of eliminating bias in other fields?
It's very difficult to fully eliminate it, but there is a really beautiful example with these online courses, the MOOCs that are becoming more popular, where the instructor, so we've long known that there are differences in how students evaluate male versus female professors at the college level. But it's hard to dissociate, well, how much of that is different styles of the male versus female instructors. And so what they did was they took online instructors, male or female, and had them present as male or present as female to different groups of students. So now it's the same instructor behaving in the same way. And so it made it possible to separate out just how the perception of the gender, the student's perception of what the gender of the instructor is, influenced their ratings. And they found big differences in how the students rated the professor. If they thought that professor was female, they rated her as less good on many dimensions than the male professor. Even something very seemingly objective, like how prompt was she in returning assignments, rated much lower, even though the actual data were the same, rated her as much less prompt if it was a female instructor.
So what do you do with that? I mean, do you call all your online professors whom the students can't see names like Chris and Pat and gender-neutral names?
Yeah, so that would be a start. Of course, that can't work in an actual physical classroom. And so there, you know, the data on the existence of bias are now quite clear. And there's been a lot of effort over the last couple of decades in establishing the kinds of biases we have. And it's not just gender. It's about race. It's about skin color. It's about height and about weight and all kinds of physical attributes. We have stereotypes about, you know, people possessing those being better or worse at different things. So there's now the phenomenon that we have these biases is well established. These are mental habits that we've developed from, you know, again, exposure to the media. And there's less research on what we can do about it. But people are starting, a number of groups are starting to research, what are the interventions that can help people to mitigate these effects of bias? Because it's not in the interest of anybody to have these biases. Most of us want to be able to make a clear, rational decision. When I'm hiring someone, I want to hire the best person. Companies should want to promote the best people. And there's a lot of evidence that companies that have women on their boards do 30% better than companies that don't. So I think there's a lot of incentive for people to be able to suppress their biases, to not let them influence their decisions. So there's ongoing research to figure out how can we help people to do that. And again, one is just awareness. We have different brain systems, the kind of thinking fast system, which is the habit system, which is where your biases have the biggest effect. You know, your gut reaction, who's the best candidate for police chief? You'll pick the male, you know, disproportionately. But if you take the time to collect more data, you take more time for your decision, you have your criteria set in advance, we want someone with certain education, with certain experience, and you really focus on the data, that can help people to overcome the bias. So you can use your more deliberate cognitive systems to suppress the effects of that gut reaction, that, you know, unconscious bias. Oh, I kind of like him better. I don't know why. By looking at the data, you can say, well, actually, on all of our criteria, it looks like maybe the female candidate is better in this one case. Because it's hard to see the effects of bias on an individual case. You have to have systems in place to help people make more objective decisions.
Now, you said earlier that you took a test that showed that you yourself were biased against women in science, or you associated men with science more than women. Do you think that that affects how you move about in the world?
Knowing that I have that tendency, sure. You know, taking the test it takes about 10 or 15 minutes. I really urge your listeners to try it. I knew that statistically women were as likely to have this bias as men, and I knew statistically that at least 70% of the population, hundreds of thousands of people have taken this test from around the world. I knew that I was likely to have this bias, and yet I was hoping I would be one of the few that didn't show a bias on this test. And as I was taking it, I could feel that my responses were slower when I had to associate women with science than men with science. And, you know, I was not happy to have that. and yet I realized it's important for us to just accept this. This is part of, you know, growing up and reading Winnie the Pooh, and all of the characters are male except Kanga, who's a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, after years and years of being exposed to images of men in the workplace, our faculty club at Stanford has a wall with all of our Nobel laureates, all of them male. And so, you know, many days per week I see that wall. And it's hard. I have to actively think, okay, I also know a lot of great female scientists. We made sure that our Fields Medal winner, this is like the Nobel Prize in mathematics, who went to a woman at Stanford, Miriam Mirzakhani, last year. We made sure her photo got up there, so I make an effort to look at her photo as a reminder that women can be great scientists and mathematicians as well. So knowing that I have that bias allows me to take these active steps to, when I'm evaluating the women in my class, to be more aware that I could be more likely to call on the men, so I can do a self-check and make sure, okay, am I calling on the women equally? Am I listening as carefully when the women speak? You know, am I offering mentoring to the women? Am I evaluating their written work in the same way? So I can kind of check myself and make sure that I'm being as objective as possible. And then the other thing about bias is that women tend to turn bias against themselves. So because women are as likely as men to see science, for example, as something that's a male-dominated field, it causes women to doubt their own abilities. There was a beautiful study done by an economist, an experimental economist named Muriel Niederle. And she took two men and two women and put them in the room and had them do a bunch of addition problems. And she paid them for every one they got right. And then she said, okay, we're going to have another round, and you can either do the same thing, get paid for every one you get right, just compete against the clock, or you can compete against the people in the room. And whoever gets the most right will get four times as much, and everyone else gets zero. Well, what do you think happens? The men choose to compete, and the women choose not to compete. So the women are opting out of the competition, and then Dr. Niederle looked and said, well, how did these people who are opting out do, or how did everybody do in the first round? And she found that the women who were in the top quartile, the best 25% overall, they were opting out at a higher rate than the men in the bottom quartile. The best women were opting out more than the very worst men. And so, you know, that tells us a lot. First of all, it tells us that we're losing the best talent. You know, we're failing to capture the best talent in our competitions that we have. And then second of all, it shows that the women are internalizing these stereotypes that women aren't good at math and opting out of a competition with the men, even when they are the best one. And it also tells us that it's not just that women aren't as interested, which is something you hear a lot in the media. Oh, women are opting out, but what can we do? That's their choice. They're not as interested. In this experiment, the women were going to do the same thing anyhow. They were going to do the same addition problems, and yet they opted out of the competition. So, you know, this shows that women are likely to turn these biases we've internalized from society against ourselves and not give ourselves the same chance to compete against the men. If you put four women in the room, they compete at almost the same rate as the men. So, it's not just that women are more risk-averse, they're really opting out. They're choosing not to compete against the men in these male-dominated fields. And so awareness of that, you know, so you asked originally how being aware of these biases affects my everyday interactions. One thing that I do now is I second-guess myself when I'm opting out. If I'm not going to apply for a competitive fellowship, is that because I'm a woman and I'm opting out because that's what women tend to do, or is it really not the best use of my time at the moment? So I encourage my female students, our female trainees, to do the same thing, to second-guess themselves when they feel like, oh, maybe I'm not good enough, I don't think I'm going to try for that competitive position, to push themselves a little bit to try to overcome that tendency to not enter the competition and to give themselves a chance.
Now, are younger people still doing the same thing, or are they maybe less biased than the previous generation?
No, unfortunately, the data suggests that these biases hold across all age groups. You know, there may be a very small trend for it to have gone down over time, because again, the place these biases come from are all of the images we're exposed to, and we're all exposed to largely the same images from the media, from, you know, the news, from the books we read. And so young people very rapidly acquire the same biases that the previous generation had. My daughter, for example, when she was young, I made a big effort to try to expose her to more balanced female and male characters in books. And yet when she was three, we were on the playground and she said, "Mom, this is a ship and I'm the captain. I'm a girl captain." And that made me realize, even though she's three and even though I've tried really hard to expose her to lots of female role models, and her mom's a scientist, that she knew she had to violate a gender stereotype if she wanted to be the captain. She had absorbed a stereotype that, you know, captains are normally boys, because otherwise she would have just said, "I'm the captain." A boy wouldn't say, "I'm a boy captain." He'd just say, "I'm the captain." So it's very hard to shelter, even if we want to, it's hard to shelter our kids from these stereotypes that have been around in the world. Just, you know, it's sort of like a historical hangover that the men have been the ones out in the world, and we're still exposed to those images, and so we still have this kind of gut reaction that, you know, most of the things happening in the world are male-driven.
We've been talking about gender bias. There's also racial bias, age bias, all kinds of things. Some people are more biased than others. Are people who are who tend to be biased against women also tend to be more racially biased? I mean, are some people just more or less biased across the board, or does it separate into different different domains?
Well, I think I don't know. I don't have a complete answer to that, but one thing I know is that, as I mentioned earlier, the more we think we are objective, the more we think we are not biased, the more likely we are to show biases on these kinds of laboratory tests of bias. So to the extent that someone thinks, "Oh no, I'm fair. I don't do any kind of, you know, favoring of one group over another," then they're more likely to show biases across the board.
Are any of these biases, do you think, based in our own primate nature, or are they all learned? I mean, what is the... Because it seems like bias is so pervasive. I'm not sure there's an unbiased culture on the face of the earth.
Yeah, so bias is learned. So bias is just a tendency to favor one thing over another or to do one thing over another. But most of our biases are learned. So, for example, if you ask a young child to draw a scientist, they're just as likely to draw, or almost as likely to draw, a woman as a man. But just a couple of years later, when they get to age 7 or 8, then they're overwhelmingly likely to draw a man. So there's an illustration that, you know, this is something we learn by exposure to our society, to our teachers, our parents, the literature. We learn biases. And our brains, so I'm a neuroscientist, our brains are constantly taking the statistics on the world. And so our biases are, you know, an important function that the brain has to learn that two things tend to go together. You know, if I see dark clouds, it's going to rain. If I smell a certain smell, there's likely to be a predator nearby. So it's important that we are able to learn these correlations between things. But because we're exposed to skewed correlations between certain genders and certain kinds of activities, then we internalize those biases and, you know, sort of are implicitly assuming that that's the way the world is. It doesn't mean that's the way the world has to be. It just means that's what I've been exposed to throughout my life.
As you said, we can change our behavior. We can become conscious of our biases. Do you think we can actually lose long ingrained biases? Can they actually go away so we don't have to be continually vigilant anymore?
This is a really important research question that people are working on now, and the answer is not clear yet, but there is some encouraging evidence that with time you can slowly reduce the bias itself. So, you know, there's two approaches. If you have this bias, one approach is just use conscious strategies to not let the bias control your behavior. The other strategy is there is some kind of training I can do to actually make my bias go away. You know, it's kind of like if you think about the habit of biting your fingernails. In the beginning, you might need to replace that habit of biting your fingernails with a conscious strategy of, you know, painting them with something that tastes bad. But over time, then that habit can go away gradually. The psychology term for that would be extinguish that habit. So there's a little bit of evidence that these stereotypes can be gradually extinguished through training. It's not easy because we're trying to overcome years or sometimes decades of training, you know, exposure to these correlations that are making up the bias. But there is some evidence that training can make it go away. And there's even some intriguing evidence that strategies of replaying, if you associate female with science and a certain tone, and then you replay that tone during sleep, that that can help to strengthen that training to reverse your biases. Another study has used stimulation of non-invasive stimulation of the prefrontal cortex. That's the executive part of your brain. Some evidence that if you stimulate that part, which would be naturally activated to suppress the biases, that it may help as well. So the research is ongoing, but there's some hope that we may be able to find ways to actually eliminate bias from our brains.
I would think that the best way would be being in a lab with a great, wonderful, happy, brilliant female scientist.
There's a lot of evidence that exposure to female role models can really influenced younger women's decisions, or, you know, kind of their view of what's possible for them and their decisions about what they'll try. So that is helpful, but it doesn't completely solve the problems, right? So I have a lab with many women in it, and yet I still have on that test, you can still see that there's some residual bias. And that's because outside of my lab, when I look at the statistics, my field is still dominated by men. And the men tend to be more visible. You know, the men are the ones who are getting the profile pieces in the scientific journals disproportionately still. And so we need to change. If we want to reduce the biases, we also need to change the images that we're exposed to.
What's the neurobiological perspective on this? Is bias like a neural habit that, I mean, you sort of talked about habit. I mean, it's a brain thing to some extent, isn't it?
Yes, it's learned. It's a learned association between concepts. We know from decades of neuroscience research that there are different kinds of learning and memory that depend on different brain systems. So these biases would be part of habit learning, part of implicit learning, learning that's there and that affects our behavior without necessarily having conscious awareness of it. There are other examples of this, like you can learn a sequence of numbers. If you're just asked to press buttons in a sequence, but you're not told there's a sequence, you're faster. You implicitly learn what the sequence is, even if you have no awareness that there was a sequence. Compared to if the buttons just light up randomly. So we have these different systems, and we have some ideas about the underlying brain structures, and we know that learning changes the structure of our neural circuits. So we can have learning going on that's promoting these biases, and then in other brain areas, we can have other kinds of learning that would tend to counter those biases. And then, you know, these different brain systems compete for control of our behavior, for control of our decisions.
Do you think there are any real gender differences that affect how men and women think and approach their fields of inquiry? I'm not talking about differences in competence, but differences in approach. I mean, do we think differently?
It is very difficult to say, because one thing we know about the brain is that it is powerfully shaped by experience. As I said, when we learn something, that changes connections in our brain. So every experience is changing connections in our brain. And we know from psychologists that girl babies and boy babies are treated differently from birth. When a boy baby cries versus a girl baby cries, we comfort them differently. We're, you know, more likely to attribute, you know, female qualities to our girl baby versus our boy babies. There are examples of parents trying to raise their babies in a gender-neutral way, and others have a very difficult time knowing how to treat a baby if they don't know its gender. So the children are treated differently throughout their life. By the time they get to college, they've had 20 years of different experience. Girls are encouraged differently. Boys are more likely to have their hands called. You know, when they have their hand up, they're more likely to be called on. After 20 years of experience, there will be differences in their brain. And lots of differences have been reported. Some of them have not been replicated. It's not clear which differences are real or not. But I expect that there should be differences because they've had, the boys and girls have had such different experiences through their life. So sure, there are differences. The question is whether there's any innate difference that's independent of that different experience. And until we get rid of the different experience, we can't know. But there's a lot of evidence that the differences that exist are driven largely by those different experiences. So if there's any innate component, it's likely to be quite small. And it's likely to be related to things like reproductive behavior, because we can see gender differences in animals, and you know, we can see differences in the brain related to those reproductive behaviors, but that's not math ability, right? That's reproduction.
Right, right. We're talking to neurobiologist Jennifer Raymond. What kind of changes have you seen in your lifetime so far, and what would you like to see in terms of reducing bias?
Well, one thing I've seen is that there is much greater awareness now than when I was training. When I was a graduate student, when I was still in a training stage of my career, we were not talking about these issues at all. It was not in the media. I was not talking about this with my friends, in large part because we thought the issue had been solved and it was just a matter of time until women caught up. So, you know, I really, until recently, didn't think there was a problem. I didn't worry about it. You know, thank you to the women who fought for equal rights in the 60s and 70s and 80s. I felt like I could go on with my neuroscience career and not worry about this. But after a while, I couldn't help but notice that the women around me were dropping out at an alarming, disproportionate rate. And the women we were training, you know, at Stanford, we were lucky to have some of the best students in the world come here to train. And yet I was seeing the women disproportionately dropping out after they completed their PhD even. But the good news is that people are starting to take note of this. It's back in the media. It's back in discussion. Students are talking about it. When we have discussion groups on the topic, lots of students are interested. So I think this interest, this renewed interest in the topic of gender equality will help us to find solutions. And as I said, the solutions aren't clear yet. I think we're going to have to innovate around it. We're going to have to try things and see what works. So some of my colleagues here at Stanford and I, we've tried things. We're reading the literature with the students. We're, you know, we have had classes on this topic. We're trying to do things to see if we can. We've had executive coaches come in and work with all of our students to try to see if we can just change the statistics a little bit. But I think it's going to take a lot of these kinds of experiments around the country, around the world, to find the interventions that are best able to overcome the bias. But the fact that people are now thinking about it, talking about it, that it's high profile in the media, should help us get there.
I was at a conference once in which a woman stood up and said, "I'm a scientist. I'm married to a scientist. I was at the top of my field. He was at the top of his field. We had kids. You explain to me how we are supposed to both stay at the top of our field when we have kids. There's no support." And she was very angry, and she basically gave up her her career trajectory at that point, not clear whether she can ever catch up. I mean, how much of it is just systemic? We have absolutely horrible infrastructure and childcare and things like that to support women, or to support families, which is how we should think about it.
Right. I think a better system for supporting families would go a long way, because it's really sad when a couple has to choose between sacrificing the career of one of them and taking care of their child. So I think we have to address that. That's a really fundamental limit. I don't think it's going to fully solve the problem unless we can change other expectations so that men are as equally likely to stay home and take care of the kids. So we have to engage the men. We have to give them the same choices that the women have. I've talked to male students who say it's harder if they want to stay home with the kids for them to feel like they could do that and then come back to the workplace. So childcare is a big issue for a lot of our young people entering the workforce. We have to address that.
I mean, another piece of it all also is workaholism. For many of us in many different fields, you're expected not to work a 40-hour week, but to work crazy hours, which make family life virtually impossible, whether you're a woman or a man.
That's another issue we've been working on here at Stanford, is trying to provide support so that the model we have of the workplace is based on the 1950s, where one partner was working, almost always the man, and the other partner was home taking care of everything else. Well, none of us, men or women, or very few of us these days, have somebody at home taking care of everything else. And so providing more support for not just families, but for people to be able to work and outsource some of those other tasks that the stay-at-home wife used to take care of, is a good strategy. And we see a lot of Silicon Valley companies trying to do that, offering on-site car washes and pet care and dry cleaning and meals, making it easier for families to outsource some of those tasks that used to be done by the stay-at-home partner also could go a long way to helping.
But it still doesn't quite address the question of leisure time, which in my personal view, I don't know how you feel about this, but actually having time to breathe and time to not work actually can make you a better professional than somebody who is pushing it so hard all the time, as many do, both in the business world and in academia.
This is another whole interesting topic, the question of whether this work ethic that we have, that's different here than in Europe or in Australia or in other developed places, whether that's really making us more competitive or whether that's limiting the extent that we can be creative. And again, a lot of the science suggests that creativity and productivity can be boosted by a brief break. So that's another problem, and it's just adding stress to the whole gender dynamics, where women often have a long work week and then have expectations that when they have time off, they're also going to be doing more at home.
Do you see and do you have ways of encouraging, where you are at Stanford, girls, high school students, and young women to go into the sciences and stay there?
Yes, we do, and it's there are many groups doing many different kinds of things. In the neurosciences, one of the things that we have been doing is sending our graduate students out to the seventh grades, which is a really critical time where girls tend to start doubting their scientific abilities, right around puberty. You see girls doing great, and then around puberty, they start to find that maybe it's not as socially acceptable for them to like math and science. So we send our graduate students out with brains into the seventh grade, and we make sure that those groups that go out represent the diversity of scientists that we have here. So we try to gender balance those groups. We send as many of our students across all of the dimensions of diversity that we have, and we try to mix those groups so they see different examples of what a scientist can be.
It's clear that obviously in the 20th century made absolutely huge strides. I mean, from women not having even basic rights like the vote, to women being admitted to universities in ever greater numbers and taking our place in the workforce and a lot more respect. Do you feel like that progress continues? Has it slowed down? Where are we at?
Yeah, we have certainly made great progress in the last few decades. And so While we still worry about things not being totally equal, it's good to remember that we have made progress and be encouraged by that. At the same time, a lot of the progress happened in the 70s and the 80s and then has leveled off in the 90s and 2000s. And so we see that all the curves for progress for women are now leveling off. In my field of neuroscience, we have reached 50-50 at the PhD level, and that has been true for over a decade. And yet, at the PhD transition to the next stage in training, which is the postdoc, we see women are still dropping off at almost twice the rate of the men. So we go from 50% at the PhD level down to 38%. And then it just drops off as you go higher up in the sort of science pipeline. And so I just kind of took the current curves and extended them out. And if we stay on the same trajectory we're on now and don't level out further, we would reach 50-50 at the assistant professor level not until 21-17.
Goodness.
Yeah, so, you know, we're improving, but we're improving so slowly, we're all going to be dead and buried before we see the equality that a lot of us are hoping for. We're not on a trajectory to reach 50-50 unless we radically change what we're doing. And in some fields, like computer science, there's even been a backward slide. So at the undergrad level, in the mid-80s, women made up about 37-38% of the majors in computer science. Now, nationally, it's down to something more like 17-18%, almost half. So we've had a backward trend in some fields, and some are predicting that that could get even worse before it gets better, given the climate for computer science right now. So there's been progress. We need to build on that, and we also need to not be complacent. We are making progress that's so slow, it's not going to fix things for our daughters or even our granddaughters unless we take action.
What is going on in computer science?
Well, there are a number of things. You know, one, people aren't sure exactly. Certainly the climate is perceived by many as being not friendly for women right now, and you see examples of this in the lawsuits that are happening in Silicon Valley. But also one idea is that there's so much interest that it has become more competitive, and that when that happens, the women get squeezed out. So if there aren't enough slots for all of the students who want to major in computer science, then biases about who's a good computer science kick in. Women also say, well, maybe that's not really me. They don't have the opportunities. And so we're not getting as many women in. So some have suggested that one way to increase the proportion of women in computer science is to increase the number of slots for computer scientists. But that's hard because there's a big demand right now, and it's hard to recruit faculty. And so you know, the more competitive the field is, the more likely the women are to get squeezed out. That said, some institutions have been changing their computer science major to try to address this. So this has happened at Stanford. I know it's happened at other places like Berkeley. Other places throughout the country are trying to change their introductory computer science classes in a way that will be more appealing to everyone, not just women, but to change some of the stereotypes about what computer science is to attract a more diverse group of students to give it a try. And many students report that they weren't thinking of themselves like, oh, I didn't really think I was the computer science type, but I took this introductory class because all the other students said I had to do it because it's so popular. And sure enough, when I got in there, hey, I realized I kind of like computer science. So by changing the way the introductory course is taught to make it more project-based and exciting, I think we're attracting more students, and in doing that, also more diverse students.
Jennifer Raymond is an associate professor of neurobiology at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.